You're listening to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, episode 27. Welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, where we bring you engaging conversations about wildlife conservation issues from all across the globe. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. On today's show, we're talking with filmmaker and animator Lucas Martel. Lucas directed the animated short film The Ocean Maker in partnership with the animation studio Mighty Coconut. The Ocean Maker is a short film without dialogue. However, it is set in a post-apocalyptic world of extreme drought, where water must be harvested from clouds. If you haven't seen this film, go check it out now. This interview will make more sense, and it'll only take 10 minutes of your time to watch it. We'll be chatting with Lucas about the role of these types of stories in conservation outreach and how a certain level of ambiguity in a story that deals with these controversial topics, like climate change, might actually be beneficial. Let's jump into this conversation. Mm-hmm. All right. I am here with Lucas Martel, who is a filmmaker and an animator who has collaborated with Mighty Coconut for his latest film, Ocean Maker. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you bet. I'm really excited for this conversation here. This is a little bit different than sort of the topics that we normally cover on the show, but I think there's some potential to have a really fascinating conversation here. I'm just going to start off by asking you how you first became interested in filmmaking.
Well, I guess I kind of came into it from a weird direction. I'd always been interested in it since I was a kid, and just never really had a whole lot of opportunities to do it. I was actually a music major in college and was playing around a lot doing a lot of stuff in the recording studio, and they also had an edit bay. So I started dabbling into, and this was back in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, when it still wasn't super easy to do this stuff on your own with home computers and all of that. But anyways, long story short, I moved to Austin thinking that I was going to be getting into sound for film and more of the music scene down here. And someone saw a visual effects shop that I had done for a little short film in college. And before I knew it, I started getting a lot of work as a visual effects artist. And then I kind of picked up and learned animation just because it was something I was always interested in.
Neat. So it sounds like you sort of came into filmmaking as an animator right from the beginning.
Yeah, pretty much. I guess in college I had directed one short that was on 16mm, but honestly that was almost more of a technical exercise than anything else. So yeah, so really I've been focused on animation pretty much since I can remember.
What is it about animation that you find most appealing?
I think part of it is the ability to the stories that I always like most are these very high concept, or these like I love sci-fi, I love all the a lot of the shorts and stuff that Pixar are doing and all that sort of stuff. So I think that the ability to come up with something and not be limited by the practicality of like, oh well, we can't get this location, or we can't get, I like to think these big ideas and these things that you can never actually go out and film. So animation is just the best way of getting those ideas on screen for me.
Are there components to the animation process that can be frustrating or difficult?
I think the whole process can be pretty frustrating and difficult. It's fun, but at the same time, it is sitting on computers for, the bulk of your existence. So it's funny because that's where we spend all of our time, but we also, most animators have kind of grown to hate computers to some extent just because they kind of take over our lives. So definitely the toughest thing about animation, especially when you're doing this sort of high-end animation, is it's just the endurance factor. My first film, which was 6 minutes long, that one took about 5 years to make. This one's 10 minutes long and it only took a year and a half, so we're getting a lot faster.
All right. Yeah, that's a dramatic improvement.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about the process, you know, and you mentioned that your first film, which is only 6 minutes, took 5 years to complete. Right. I mean, I imagine a lot of that was sort of a learning process for you.
Yeah, it's essentially that was how I learned to do animation. I didn't have any formal training. So by going through the process of that first film, which is called Pigeon Impossible, by the way, it's on YouTube if people want to check it out. That was pretty much my sort of, my wife jokingly refers to it as that Pigeon Impossible was my grad school. That was me just sort of sitting in a room, banging my head against the wall for 5 years until the film was released. And I had some help on it, but that one I did probably about 75 or 80% of the work on it. Whereas with the second one, the new one here, I was able to bring on a small crew of people, and that's part of the reason that we were able to get it done so much faster, is that, you know, we had a dedicated team of people working on it for a chunk of time. So,
gotcha. Yeah, I love that you compare working on your first film to graduate school, right? I mean, it's funny, you know, the first film that I produced was an hour long documentary. Uh-huh. It took me about the same amount of time to complete it as it took you to complete your film. Mm-hmm. Obviously, documentary is very different than animation, but I use that same comparison often, you know, sort of comparing it to a graduate school program. You know, it's just a huge learning process, and you know, when you're doing it on your own and teaching yourself as you go, it's a good way to do it. There's a lot of frustration, but I think ultimately you probably get more out of it than maybe you even would going through a legitimate graduate school program.
Yeah, having actually done it, the whole thing sort of soup to nuts. And documentaries are in many ways the same sort of thing, just because most documentaries, it's not unusual for them to take years and years to produce. And typically documentaries don't have large budgets, so it's you going out with the camera, or you know, kind of piecemealing it, finding volunteers and stuff. So honestly, the documentary world is more similar to animation than a lot of the live action, you know, the dramatic live action stuff. So
right, you know, that's interesting, and I hadn't really drawn on that comparison, but that definitely makes sense for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So your latest film, which is called Ocean Maker, was just recently released, this was a part of sort of an Earth Day campaign, right? So this is a film that I guess had a certain level of sort of, it had an environmentalist component to it. Maybe you could just start off by giving us sort of a brief synopsis of the film.
Yeah, well, so The Ocean Maker, it all takes place in a sort of post-apocalyptic world after all of the oceans have dried up. And the only source of water is the clouds. So the story is all about this pilot who's trying to seed the clouds to make it rain. But in order to do that, she has to contend with all of the air pirates who are going up into this cloud with big nets and catching the water out of the clouds, because that's the only water source that they have. So it's this this sort of big action drama. And yeah, there's definitely a pretty strong environmental message to it. We were trying very hard not to hit people over the head with it. I think that's a very delicate, you know, line I prefer stuff that is a little bit more open to interpretation, but obviously the environmental message was strong enough because Earth Day was very excited about it, and they distributed it as part of their Climate Week program and did a bunch of stuff, you know, with that. But yeah, the Earth Day collaboration is actually something that happened after the fact.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I definitely want to get into some of these big picture questions, right, which you sort of just started to touch on about, you know, your approach and how you portray these sort of subtle environmental issues in the film. But let's start off just with sort of basic idea, you know, like where did the seed for this story idea come from?
Well, let me first say spoiler alert, because if you haven't seen the film yet, it'll be much, much easier to just go watch it, because the where the idea for the short came from was that there's one image of the two planes flying head to head with the cloud in the middle. And I had had that image in my head for about 6 years. And I had no idea what the story was. I just knew that it was the end of a story, the climax of a story. I just didn't know what that story was. So I was playing around with that idea a little bit more one day, and I started thinking, well, maybe the cloud is the thing that they're fighting over. And this whole idea of a world without water all kind of spilled out of that that one image. And then it was also fueled by here in Texas, we've been in a drought for several years. So going out to the lake near Austin, we've been seeing, you know, boats just sitting in the middle of a more or less dry lake bed for a while. So there was a lot of very topical things that also kind of came in to fuel that the visuals in this world.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I love that your original idea, or sort of the source of this idea, came from just this one image, which is sort of the way, I mean, which is what sort of brings together all these different components of your story. It's, I mean, that's your ending, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So I wonder why this film has no dialogue in it.
Right.
And I guess I'm wondering what sort of the thought process was, you know, in deciding not to include any dialogue in this.
You know, that was, we had actually tried a cut of it with some dialogue at one point, just to try to set up the world a little bit more. But ultimately, we knew from the beginning that we were going in a direction of at least minimal dialogue, because it makes the film so much more cinematic, and it really allows the music to sort of carry. To carry things. And also, I think that comes down to what we were talking about. You know, I want the message to be clear, yet at the same time, I don't want to hit people over the head with it. And so leaving it a little bit more open to people's interpretation, I think, is one way of doing that. And so ultimately, we tried a cut that had a couple bits of dialogue in it, and we were just realizing, you know what, we've got 90% of the film working without it. Let's find a way to sell these last couple of ideas or things that we were going to cover with dialogue in a way without it. And honestly, it kind of also goes into the format of the story itself, because it's really just one character sitting in a cockpit. And most of the story is told by the movement and the actions of these planes flying through the sky. So it was just sort of inherent in the setup of the story that we didn't have to include dialogue. And so at a certain point, we made a conscious effort. It's like, no, we're gonna do this whole thing without words. And it was kind of a challenge, but I do think that it really made things much more cinematic as a result.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think the approach worked very well. And I'm curious about, you know. It feels like you're sort of thrown into this world right, at the start of the film, and you don't have any dialogue to sort of explain the backstory. And it sort of feels like you're relying on sort of like a baseline societal knowledge of, you know, what might have caused this environmental destruction. You know, most people who watch it would probably assume that this was something, you know, maybe this was something caused by climate change, but that's not directly addressed.
Right.
And so, I mean, I wonder, I mean, was it your intention to leave sort of the cause of the destruction in this world that you created ambiguous?
Yeah, and I should say that I actually have a feature version of the script. Essentially, the short film is like the first 10 minutes of what would eventually become the feature. It's all sort of like the prologue. And so in the feature version, we do actually go a bit more into that backstory, and we explain exactly what happened. And there is a very specific event that I have in mind that I think will be it will be satisfying and yet also a little surprising to people. But for the short, we realized that, you know, the setup in the world was enough of just showing, if you showed this aircraft carrier sitting in the, you know, in the middle of a desert, and the submarine, and all of these, just these couple of shots at the beginning, and people get enough of the world that they can kind of start, it kind of gets their imagination working on your, as a filmmaker, it gets them, you know, putting their imagination to help you tell the story a little bit. And I think it also kind of helps hook people a little bit more. You know, you're not just going in with this long description of what happened. You're jumping right into it, and, you know, it kind of just sucks you in a little bit more because of it.
Great, great. Well, I'm excited to hear that you have a script for a feature-length version of this film. That was one of the questions I had for you later on. So that's exciting to hear. I'm excited to see how that develops over time. But I kind of want to jump into a little bit of a discussion of, you know, the idea of sort of using films like this, you know, films that sort of present this dystopic view of the world that is maybe caused by, you know, environmental degradation in general, or, you know, even climate change specifically.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of debate, you know, within the environmental community over the effectiveness of these types of messages, you know, and there are a handful of Hollywood produced narrative films that have come out over the past several decades that are set in climate change induced sort of post-apocalyptic landscapes.
Yeah.
You know, Waterworld is sort of the first one that jumps, to mind, which, you know, whether or not that did anything good for the issue is, you know, like,
yeah, we're always reluctant to get, and so many people have made the comparison between this because it is essentially sort of Waterworld in reverse.
Right.
So that, yeah, that's come up a couple of times. And yeah, there were some good parts to that movie. Just overall, it had a kind of a hokey factor. But going back to what you were just talking about, I know one of the big things that I had said from the beginning of this film that I something that I wanted to do that I think kind of helps it stand out a little bit is that it is a post-apocalyptic film, but I wanted to do a post-apocalyptic film about hope. And so one of the things that we tried really, really hard to do in this is that it presents this sort of bleak future, but at the same time, it's not the typical post-apocalyptic thing where it's just about trying to survive or, you know, there's so many of these films that get extremely, extremely violent. And obviously there's some, you know, there's some gunplay and some dogfights and stuff, but ultimately we wanted to sort of set the stage for this even larger story that's about people trying to fix the problem and not just survive in this world.
I guess a lot of the debate, you know, that circles around stories like this, you know, and whether or not they can be used as sort of effective ways of sort of education or outreach in relation to environmental issues or climate change specifically, is, well, yeah, a lot of these discussions sort of focus on another film that is very much, you know, focused on climate change, which is The Day After Tomorrow, which was very controversial, right? And I mean, it seems to have created a certain amount of backlash against this type of story, you know, maybe just because, you know, a lot of people talk about how the science wasn't totally accurate, you know, and how it sort of presented this view of sort of the situation in relation to climate change as, you know, this is something that would only happen in a science fiction story, you know, and
yeah,
it's so over the top. It's like, it almost makes it less believable.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the other big things that we were kind of trying to do differently in this one is that, as you mentioned, The Day After Tomorrow in particular is one movie, and like a lot of movies, it's really a disaster movie. It's about what happens and it's showing this sort of mass destruction. With our story, one of the things that we were trying to do very differently from that is that this takes place in sort of a, you know, in my mind, this is hundreds of years down the road from where we're at today. So it's almost this this world that sort of rebuilt itself, and it's obviously sort of a post-apocalyptic world, but at the same time, society has kind of rebuilt itself. There's still people, it's, you know, it might not exactly be a, you know, an ideal society, but it's not just about the disappearance of the oceans. It's about sort of trying to get back after that. So I think that's probably one area that sort of is relative, I guess I would say maybe more new, because so many of the films, especially in this post-apocalyptic genre, talk about the downfall, and it's the moment that you get the zombie outbreak and it's people learning to survive. Whereas this is just sort of using that as a setup, and we're going, you know, hundreds of years into the future to sort of start looking at what the solution might be. So at least that was what I was trying to do with it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely an interesting approach. And those are the types of stories that I actually find most appealing. You know, I'm a bit of a sci-fi nerd myself. You know, I definitely gravitate towards these sort of post-apocalyptic stories.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that's the type of story that I appreciate the most. Or,
yeah,
you know, where you know, it really takes that thought experiment to the next level when you're thinking about, you know, further down, you know, further down the road, further into the future.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it also seems like, you know, getting back to, you know, just sort of the way you structured this story, you know, you avoid a lot of these concerns about getting the science right, which is, you know, that was sort of the primary, you know, I guess, argument against the effectiveness of The Day After Tomorrow, is that, you know, the science wasn't totally accurate. So it, you know, it presents this idea of climate change creating an apocalypse as, you know, something that would only happen in a science fiction film, right? But I mean, you're not even focused on that. You just throw the viewer into this world and sort of leave it up to their imagination as to, you know, how this might have come about.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and we could have talked about, or, you know, we could have showed that, or we could have done a little intro, but that was, I guess, this never anything that we were interested in. We were more kind of interested in showing this world as it sort of all, you know, as something that already exists. We didn't feel like we needed to connect all of those dots. And yeah, I do think that leaving it open to interpretation, it helps avoid some of those things. And it probably becomes a little less of a, it might shift the conversation over to, from being a, well, this is what happened, you know, we're not trying to be preachy with it. We're not being like, this is what climate change will do. This is what, you know, how all this stuff will happen. It's more of a just thinking about the world. And honestly, probably one of the bigger elements that people have been talking about, especially in the conservation world, is more about the sort of, because there are kind of some metaphors that people have drawn in terms of how people are going after the cloud within the film. And you've got sort of this larger commercial sort of group that's sort of taking control. And I think there's probably some more metaphorical stuff that could be drawn from it, as opposed to exact, you know, we're not trying to represent climate change exactly. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. Yeah, there's definitely some metaphors you could draw just by sort of watching this, this sort of battle for water within this single cloud that we see in the film. And definitely sort of, you know, parallels you could draw towards different approaches towards adapting to climate change.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause I mean, people still need to drink. So
exactly. Mm-hmm. So there really have been very few representations of climate change issues in popular narrative film since The Day After Tomorrow came out, which was, you know, I looked this up before jumping on this interview. That was over 10 years ago. Now that film came out 11 years ago. And there's just been, I mean, there are a few examples of films that, you know, sort of incorporate climate change into, you know, sort of small components of the story. And there's a few that have sort of dealt with it head on, but, you know, none that have been, you know, sort of the big box office hit that Day After Tomorrow was.
Right.
I mean, it almost seems like this sort of subgenre, which, you know, if you read about it online on some of these, you know, film review blogs, that, you know, they call it cli-fi, right?
Yeah.
It almost seems like this subgenre has died out. You know, I mean, are you mentioned that, you know, you're sort of working on developing this film into a feature. Are you hoping to bring this subgenre back?
You know, that's interesting, because you've done research that I haven't done. So you'll have to send me your notes on some of that stuff, because that could be very useful as I'm pitching this around. I mean, in the feature version, I don't want to give too much away. We do delve a little bit sort of more into that. But I guess the interesting thing is that it almost is more of a, because of the future that it takes place in, because it's so far down the road, it's almost more of a, if you were talking about the intricacies of some of the plot, it starts to almost become more of a terraforming thing, where we're literally, the characters are literally having to figure out how to terraform the Earth. Now, how that plays out is much more in terms of the, you know, the struggle between the different factions and more of a, you know, it's not exactly, I know I love the Mars trilogy.
Oh, yeah, I'm a big fan of that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. That one's fantastic. We have Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars. If you haven't read that, check that out, because yeah, that's essentially a book about, or a trilogy kind of about terraforming the surface of Mars. And we've got some threads of that, but we definitely look back at one point and we kind of talk more about what happened, but it's trying to look forward and trying to present more solutions, at least, you know, solutions to this fictional world that we've made up.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I like that. And I like the reference to the Mars trilogy. That is one of my all-time favorite science fiction stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Neat.
It's the Mars trilogy, but we've got junkyard planes in it. So I love that.
Nice. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do you think, can stories like this, do they have the potential to affect change in this issue? I mean, is that something that you have been thinking about as you go about, you know, bringing this story to life?
You know, I guess that's never really been my prime concern. Obviously, I've got some, you know, just me personally, I've got some views on the issue of climate change, and a lot of it comes down more to just sort of what we're doing to the planet, and even beyond just climate change. So I guess I've never been super focused on that specifically. I do think that it can make a dent. I don't think that a film like this is necessarily going to be the thing that, you know, there's never going to be that one thing that totally, you know, changes everyone's mind and galvanizes everyone in support of this one thing. But I think that it opens it up for discussion. And by taking this more, this less heavy-handed approach, I hope that we can also reach some of the people who are a bit more on the other side of it and just present it as sort of like, you know, it's a relatively easy way in. The film has some very environmental aspects of it, but I think it's easy to digest, and there's enough other stuff there that might start opening people up to just start thinking about that.
This is something that I think about a lot in the films that I produce, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, the stuff that I'm working with is, you know, it's a lot of science. It's a lot about communicating, you know, research and scientific ideas to a general audience, and finding the best way to do that. You know, we're not producing content without dialogue like you are. But I mean, you know, I think it's always important. And this is something that I tell, you know, all of the scientists that we work with, is that, you know, it's less important to get your scientific research and across. What you want to do is inspire people to learn more about the topic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And,
exactly.
Yeah, and if you can produce something, I mean, you're producing something that is, you know, has a very broad general appeal, and if it just gets people thinking about, you know, these are maybe, you know, some of the potential, you know, long-term effects of climate change, then we're getting somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And finding a way to also sort of put some faces to it, because there's the film takes place within this world, but ultimately it's about the main character, what she's trying to do, and the sacrifice that she makes. So I think that it's almost more about putting that sort of human face, even though she's animated, but you know what I mean? Putting that sort of that face and sort of showing the action, sort of what she has to do in order to do what she believes is right. So
yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want you to talk a little bit about sort of the reception that you've gotten towards the film, or at least this short version that you released as a part of this sort of Earth Day campaign. What kind of responses to the film have you gotten so far?
It's been fantastic. I mean, yeah, everyone who has seen it and then come and told me anything about it has been just you know, very, very, very impressed and you know, very, very pleased to see it. I'm trying to think. I've been at a couple of film festivals and kind of gotten into a bit more of the environmental debate, and I think that goes back to what it wasn't even as much a debate, because it tended to be a couple of people who came up to me and who had said that they were more on the other side of the environmental thing, but they still really enjoyed and respected the piece, and they thought that it did a very good job of sort of presenting this world and this idea, but again, in a way that didn't, you know, that wasn't, they didn't feel turned off by it. So I guess as specifically within the environmental aspect of that, I think that's probably one of the most interesting sort of things that's come out of it, is those conversations that have come up around it.
Yeah, that's huge, right? I mean, because that's really, you know, I mean, not to say that that's your target audience, because you're obviously going for a very sort of, you know, broad
right.
appeal with your story. And I think it definitely has that appeal. But the fact that you can reach folks who maybe don't believe 100% in climate change, you know, or maybe questioning some of these issues, the fact that you can reach them and they can come up to you and you know, say that they've enjoyed the story, right? And I mean, mm-hmm. you've reached them, you know, maybe it didn't convert them, you know, or didn't, you know, make them understand the importance of this issue right off the bat, but they're thinking about it, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So, and that's the first step. That's where you got to start. So that's huge. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, yeah, one of the comments that I know I just seen recently that someone had posted online was, and they said the same thing. They loved the film. They were, they don't really, they're especially not in support so much because one of the big elements of the film, because it's the hero is trying to seed the clouds, which is sort of geo-climate control. And that's definitely something that's a bit more... that's a bit more fringe and definitely has many fewer supporters in terms of people talking about starting to put stuff into the atmosphere in order to actually try to, you know, actively control what's happening to the climate. And that starts to get into a whole different area. And, you know, for this film, it worked a little bit more because we're presenting this very bleak world, and this bleak future where that's sort of the only hope remaining. So, but yeah, it's interesting that it's kind of touched on a few of those different things that people have responded to.
Yeah, for sure. And people are, you know, people are sort of looking at your film and they're digging deeper and pulling out these little elements and interpreting it. And mm-hmm. you got them thinking about it, right?
Yeah.
Which is the mm-hmm. most important thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about this partnership that you developed with the Canopy Project for the Earth mm-hmm. Day release.
Essentially, I mean, it's because of the environmental aspect of the film and because I personally am definitely wanting to do more personally. As a filmmaker, I don't really have a whole lot to offer in terms of funds to, you know, support some as these causes as much as I'd like. So we thought, well, why don't we sort of use the film? And so essentially we made it so that anyone who bought, who purchased, we did an early access thing through Vimeo On Demand where I guess about a month before we did the wide release that we just did recently here. Anyone who bought the film could see it early. They get access to some bonus features. And for everyone who bought the film, we planted a tree through the Canopy Project. So, yes. So it was a great partnership and just a way to sort of reach back and give something back to the community and, you know, just sort of spread the love a little bit.
Fantastic. So, yeah. This is something that is still available, right? I think I saw that folks can still, through Vimeo On Demands, they can still purchase like a bonus features version of the film.
Exactly. And it's essentially because we've released the film now, the thing that people can still get access to is the, it's essentially we've got four commentary tracks and we also have a music only version of the film because a lot of people were asking where they could hear the score. And it's only 10 minutes long, but our composer Chris Raymond did a fantastic job. And without for a film that doesn't have words, the music really kind of carries the narrative in many ways. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So mm-hmm. Maybe you can just tell folks where they can go to watch the film and learn more about the project.
Oh, the easiest thing to do is just go to oceanmaker.com, all one word.
Thanks a lot, Lucas, for coming on the show and chatting about this really interesting project.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, that was our conversation with Lucas Martel, film director and animator responsible for The Ocean Maker, which you can watch right now at the film's website. I must say that I really did not anticipate the level of thought that Lucas has put into the environmental components of his story and how these environmental components might be able to play a positive outreach role. And of course, it's always exciting for me to meet another fan of the science fiction Mars trilogy written by Kim Stanley Robinson, which comes highly recommended from both Lucas and myself, apparently, if you're looking for a good summer read. As usual, we'll have the links to Lucas's film and the animation studio Mighty Coconut up on the show notes page for this episode, which you can find at wildlensinc.org/EOC27. Today's episode was produced by myself, your host, Matt Podolsky. Our theme music is by The Humidors.